Coming up this week on the Course of Life podcast, we had a surprising onslaught of golf for a mid-December week, but a very enjoyable one at that. Great weekend with the Women's U.S. Open, a QBE shootout, and a great finish in the Race to Dubai and the Euro Tour as well. We're getting tuned in with some new music. Got to talk a little Taylor Swift as well, of course. And this week's guest, perfect for the winter vibes, cooking with fire season is here. So we've got chef and TV host Roger Mooking from Man Food Fire on the Cooking Channel, also hosts Man's Greatest Food. We get into all sorts of live fire cooking and some really cool tips from him as well. And we finish with our Christmas meal ideas when we hashtag always end with food. All of it is brought to you by our friends at Active Body. And Mike, I just did a FaceTime this past weekend with my mom and stepdad back home, and they were asking about this thing because they keep hearing me talk about Active Body on the podcast.
The
I bring it up a lot.
All the time.
And it's because it's just that easy to use. You got one, I got one. It's a 5-minute workout where you can literally just use the strength of your own muscles. You don't need any sort of equipment. You don't need a lot of space. It's a really convenient tool, this Active 5 unit. And with our promo code COL, you can save 20% off the Active 5 unit. Get it for yourself. Add it to your daily routine. Again, real quick 5 to 10 minute workouts with Active Body and the Active 5 unit. Our promo code is COL for 20% off activebody.com.
Interwebs, and welcome to Course of Life, part of the Morning Read Podcast Network. We are proud to be presented by our friends at Desert Fox Golf and Groove It Golf. I'm Michael, he's Alex. And Alex, it was a crazy weekend in golf for mid-December. Let's start where we should be, at the final major championship of the year, the U.S. Yes. Women's Open in Houston. And I said it last week if we might have a rookie win, and we did. We had A. Lim Kim win at her major debut, becoming one of now just 7 players to make a 5-stroke comeback in the final round. She won the U.S. Open 3-under on Monday.
Yeah, Monday finish, wet, damp conditions in Texas, Mike. Storm came through here through the weekend, and Houston tends to get the worst of those Gulf systems. And you saw that if you were watching the action at Champions at just outside the city. It was yucky out there. You know what it's like when it's that cold, wet, misty, kind of breezy, temperatures in the 50s. They had the hats, the hoodies, the winter gloves, the mittens in between shots working. So it was quite a grind out there. To see A. Lim Kim win, not only kind of convincingly in that comeback fashion, but Mike, I think this is a first. She won with a mask, playing with a mask during the round. Yeah. I don't think I'd quite seen that before. This may be our first and possibly last and only major champion to win with a mask. So definitely an interesting note to history there as well.
Yeah, wearing the mask during the round, not wearing the mask during her promotional photo holding the trophy, but that's, you know, okay.
It was interesting. It was just an interesting sight to see nonetheless, but shout out to A. Lim Kim for the impressive victory in just, like I said, really brutal conditions. You know just how cruddy the golf ball and club can feel when you're in weather like that and you're playing, it's just damp and dreary and there's zero humidity at all and the air just does not feel right. It was not an ideal golf scenario week. They had a Monday finish, but like you said, the rookie getting it done for an impressive win in the U.S. Women's Open.
Let's also give a shout out to first round leader Amy Olson, who then learned on Saturday of her father-in-law's death and was still able to rally herself, ended up tied for 2nd at 2-under.
That is awesome.
That's just impressive to be able to play after that.
And you know what? She's shown up on a lot more reader boards recently. So we're looking forward to seeing her notch a big win real soon. It's coming for her. Lots of Americans and lots of younger Americans showed their face on the leaderboard, which was a nice surprise as well, too. So the diversity in women's golf really showing right now, and glad that they got to sneak this major in. I know it wasn't under the most ideal circumstances, but they got in the major at the end of the year. And now pretty much collectively, the tours take a break for a couple of weeks before we reset things in January.
Yeah, and just the one thing that was disappointing about, I think most disappointing about moving the U.S. Women's Open off of Sunday and into a Monday finish was how instead of this being maybe the premier golf event to happen on Sunday, on network TV,
yeah,
it became like, where are you going to see it?
It's like it was the perfect at bat for women's golf. Like it was just the perfect setting for them, you know, late, you know, just cooler weather around the nation and a good television watching weekend for lots of people who may have just tuned into a women's golf tournament for the first time. Would have loved to have had that Sunday finish, but ended up being the Monday finish and a good one at that.
Let's talk about what did happen, though, Friday through Sunday in Naples, Florida. That was the QBE shootout. This was the team event on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, and tons of birdies. It's obviously a birdie fest when you know you team up two PGA Tour players together and let them play in a best ball scenario. That, you're just asking for low scores. And we got insanely low scores. But before we talk about the winner, who we're regretting a little bit, we got to shout out our boy Kevin Na. He was putting on an absolute clinic on the greens, Mike. Be sure to go back after we hop off recording and anyone else out there. Just check out the Friday highlights of his round. He was rolling them in with Sean O'Hare from everywhere.
He was walking in putts before he hit the putt, right?
Yes, he was. He's known to do that as well, too. You remember even Justin Bieber did an Instagram video impersonation of Kevin Na walking in putts. That's how culturally appropriated that is at this point. So, you know, if you're seeing a putt get walked in, it's probably done by Kevin Na. So shout out to Na and O'Hare. They had a good week, but nowhere near as good as the champions did this week.
Yeah, three-time now champions at the shootout, English and Kucher. Kucher.
And we have our feelings about Matt Kucher. Everyone knows that here that listens to the podcast. But
they won by 9 strokes.
Yeah, 37 under was their finishing score for the week. 3-day team tournament, best ball style. That's just impressive stuff no matter how you shake it. I don't care what two golfers they are. If you give them 3 rounds and they put together 37 under as a team, that's just damn impressive. So they seem to love this venue at Tiburon in Naples. Their third time notching it, like you said. Shout out to Kucha and Harris English, who just put on a ball striking clinic as well. Nice win for them.
Let's go across the pond to the Euro Tour.
That's right. So the race to Dubai also finished on Sunday. Like I said at the top, a surprisingly busy weekend here in golf. We usually don't have this much material this time of year, Mike. I mean, I'm not going to lie. We got a lot to talk about here, but the race to Dubai finished and Matthew Fitzpatrick got the win, which is notable because we've mentioned his name recently in circles around Bryson DeChambeau, who is a very popular topic. Obviously, Matt Fitzpatrick came out, Mike, and said about a month or two ago, kind of criticized Bryson, said he wasn't sure how much skill is required to do what Bryson is doing. He caught a lot of flack for those comments, and a lot of people were asking, hey, Matt, are you going to show up and start winning tournaments on your own? He notched a big win this weekend in Dubai to kind of answer the critics there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of Bryson. I don't know. I don't think either of us really are big fans of Bryson. But I will say there is a lot of skill that goes into what he does, because just being big and being able to hit something hard doesn't mean that you're able to get the timing right to actually hit it straight.
Yeah. And Matt Fitzpatrick angle was just kind of like, oh, I'm Bryson, big, strong guy, hit ball far. Don't think about anything. Like, I think he kind of thought about it from that perspective, but he's really not thinking about kind of literally the equations, the science, all the madman things that Bryson incorporates into his game, in addition to being like ripped as hell and jacked now these days in 2020. So a lot to think about there, but nonetheless, impressive win for Matt Fitzpatrick. And you'll appreciate this. The race to Dubai is basically like the FedEx Cup for the European Tour.
Yes.
Lee Westwood got the season-long win in the race to Dubai points, his third race to Dubai championship. And I think it's the first one he's done in like 15 years, 20 years.
I was going to say, how old is Lee Westwood now?
He's 46, 47. So really impressive to see at this age. At this age, he's still cranking it out and consistent enough to win that season-long race. So shout out to the Euro Tour finishing things in style in Dubai. They do all sorts of fun stuff in the winter months as well. I'm thinking there's some sort of Australian swing in the next few weeks. More travels upcoming for the Euro Tour.
Let's talk about this weekend, because it is the now much anticipated PNC Championship and father-son event of the year, because Tiger is going to be in it. So Tiger, that's going to be fun.
Tiger and Charlie Woods. So just to catch people up who like aren't following Tiger Woods' life super close now, Tiger's son is growing up now. I believe he's 11. I think he's either 10 or 11 years old now. He's been spotted in the last year or two competing in and taking down a lot of junior golf tournaments against kids his age. There was even a funny photo that circulated, which you remember a few months ago, where Tiger was actually on the bag caddying for his son in one of the tournaments. Mm-hmm. And ever since that happened, the rumor mill just started swirling like, we want more Charlie. I know we're completely objectifying this kid to the media and the public spotlight, but everyone is very fixated on Tiger Woods' son right now. And we're finally going to get an opportunity to actually like see him like hit shots, not only on camera, but besides his father too.
Yeah, it should be interesting. And of course, the one of the big things we heard about why this was happening was Justin Thomas. And Justin Thomas's kid being in here too.
That's right.
Because because Charlie, Tiger's kid, wants to beat Justin Thomas, right? Isn't that really what this is all about?
Yeah, there's a little rivalry. So basically, Justin Thomas is like Tiger's little like teacher's pet who just like follows him around Jupiter all the time. He's like, hey, Tiger, want to practice, Tiger, want to play. So Justin Thomas and Charlie have gotten to be good friends and kind of gotten very competitive. Charlie's at that point where he's teeing off from the junior tees and JT and Tiger are playing all the way back. And Charlie's getting close to beating them now, I'm hearing. So there's a lot of competition within those four as well, too. Justin Thomas and his dad are also going to be playing in this tournament. Those are your two favorites right there, those two guys. So I'm thinking and hoping they're going to get paired together for at least Friday. Maybe we'll see what happens in the weekend. But I think that's kind of the main storyline. There's some other fun couples, which we can get to in a minute here. But really, the Thomases and the Woods are the four that I'm watching this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, those are good. Let's also talk when I look at who else is in this field. Bubba Watson is going to be here. And of course, he just had a good week at the QBE shootout.
Yeah, that's right.
He actually played recently. Also, Annika Sorenstam.
That's so cool. I love that. Mm. Love seeing Annika there. I got to shout out Big and Little John Daly. They're going to be in there. Now, Little John is a sight to be seen because he's basically like a teenage version of his dad, except he's like trimmer and with like a like more impressive golf swing. He takes it all the way back, just like his dad too. Not afraid to hit the long ball. And we've said this before in the podcast, but once you watch Little John Daly hit a golf ball, you're just going to feel very inadequate as a human being, no matter what your age is. So look out for that.
I feel inadequate anytime I watch a PGA Tour event. The kids are just as good.
Now watching these teenagers make us feel even more inadequate and adequate. And got to shout out the Longers as well, too. Watch out for Bernhard Langer and his son. I think he's won this with like a couple different sons before. I don't even care which one he's playing with. I would watch out for him as well, too. Like you mentioned, again, the PNC father-son challenge
Did you know, by the way, since this happened around Christmas, did you know that PNC has a Christmas price index?
No, it sounds great, though, and it's the holidays, so do share.
Well, the question is, what is the price index calculated with? There's the question for you. I want you to think about this. I just learned this weekend at a virtual trivia.
Price index calculated with? I have no idea.
What do they use to calculate the price index of Christmas?
I don't know. Like average spend amount or something budget or something like that? Nope. What's the answer?
They use the cost of buying all the gifts from the song The 12 Days of Christmas.
Wow, that's so archaic, but I love it.
Here's the real question. How much do you think it costs? Now, the price actually dropped 58.5% this year because the last four items on the list, namely the 9 Ladies Dancing, 10 Lords of Leaping, 11 Pipers Piping, and 12 Drummers Drumming, are not available in 2020 because of the pandemic.
Yeah, and I mean, what's the price of gold for 5 golden rings? That's the first thing I'm thinking of. French hens, I don't know what the market price on them these days is, but it's probably not that much. You can probably get them for the low. So
let me help you out with the 7 Swans of Swimming is $13,125.
That's great. So the Christmas price index.
Yeah. So this year to buy everything that is available on the market, $16,168.14.
Noted. I will start saving up for next year and we'll get
Everything's available, it's going to be about $40,000. Just letting you know
I'll check what the ship time on all that is and I'll get back to you. But good to know. The more you know, the Christmas Price Index brought to you by PNC. So shout out to PNC, not only for producing that wonderful material, for bringing the father-son to us this weekend. So check it out, NBC. It's going to be a fun weekend watch with Tiger and Charlie Woods in action.
Let's move over to Tuned In, where we share what we're tuning into the world outside of the world of sports. I'm going to start here. I'm getting into some new music right now. Not really new music from one of my favorite artists, which is Bleachers. I'm a little month to their two new singles that just dropped, Chinatown featuring Bruce Willis and 45. Here's the thing. This is going to be my segue. I'm a big fan of Bleachers, by the way. I just love their sound. It's Jack Antonoff, who's the lead singer, kind of the creative force behind the band. His stuff is just amazing to me. It's really easy to listen to over and over again. Produces
that segue. Jack Antonoff, BFF with Taylor Swift, too, who also put the music.
Yeah, T-Swift, Lord, Lana Del Rey. He does all this stuff. And, of course, T-Swift, I know you're listening to her new album. Didn't we just say this about a month ago?
Yeah, I know. Seriously, Jack Antonoff's one of those like secret figures who's like quietly involved in every part of the music industry. And you just don't really know it until you look in the credits. I appreciate that shout out. And work with T-Swift. Again, another one. We just had Full Floor. Now we have Evermore. Jack Antonoff did a lot with her on this album as well. A little bit more upbeat, I feel like. Folklore was a little bit quarantine-y. Mm-hmm. The vibes were way down low. This is kind of a comeback album for T-Swift as she hits her 30s running now. A little bit more energy. I enjoy Willow, the lead single. It's good timing for the holidays. A lot of people are going to be sitting around at home in the comforts of their home next few weeks. Easy to throw music on and let it run for the days during the holiday season. So definitely something I would consider having everyone give a listen to. I like it 1 to 2 steps above what I liked from Folklore, which I said, it was just a little bit more down in the dumps. So a little bit more of an upbeat vibe from T-Swift on this new project.
Looking forward to it. It's also, we should say, it's Hanukkah. It's the middle of Hanukkah. It's night 5 right now. It's Monday night, night 5.
That's right. I put in our notes that I saw a Hallmark Hanukkah movie. How about that?
Starring Ben Savage of all people.
Shut up, boy.
I can see in the notes here.
There was brisket. There was challah. There was latkes.
I made latkes last night.
There was all sorts of Jewish American traditions going on in the Hallmark holiday Hanukkah movie. I was actually surprisingly locked into the movie. It was very entertaining. So shout out Ben Savage. First time I'd seen him in decades since Boy Meets World.
Did it follow the same story as all the Hallmark Christmas movies? Was it about a woman going back to her hometown? And instead of celebrating Christmas, she's just wrapped up in Hanukkah and she loves Hanukkah. There's someone there who hates Hanukkah who's trying to like beat it down or something. Like
opposition and hate. You got the first half right. And then, of course, Ben Savage is the nice, wonderful guy who seems to always be at all the family and friend functions, who just seems to be the right fit for you. Why don't you go after him, honey? You know,
the problem is if you get too much hating on Hanukkah, you're being anti-Semitic. So we can't have that.
That's right. So shout out to Ben Savage in the Hallmark Hanukkah movie. Premiering last weekend. We're tuned in, aren't we? We are just tuned in gets right now.
It's just more Christmas and Hanukkah nonstop for the rest of the month. Nonstop.
Yes.
But let's turn our attention to this week's guest. Alex, it's the winter, which means there's a lot of cool weather relative to where you are.
Exactly. Like, that in Texas terms is like the highs are down to like 60 and the lows are down to like 40. That's
what we got. That's what we got here in Savannah. Same thing here. But what that also means, though, is that you can light a fire in the backyard following fire safety codes, obviously.
That's right. Get your fire pits out. I got the electric one. I got the like space heater outdoors I'll whip out every once in a while. I'm a big fire guy. So that's why this next guest will intrigue not only people who love the food content, but just a good fire as well, too.
Yeah. It's the host of Man Fire Food on the cooking show, Chef Roger Mooking.
That's right. Very cool conversation. We get into his shows. Beyond Man Fire Food, talk about a New England lobster boil, Mike. We talk about live fire barbecue in Texas. Get some tips for people who are interested in maybe doing a little live fire cooking of their own. We touch all the bases in this interview.
It's going to be great. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, as always, we want to let you know that this conversation is brought to you by our friends at Groove It Golf, makers of the Groove It Golf Brush. It is available for pre-order. It's still in high demand, and it's all because it's not your average golf brush.
Not, Mike, and I saw on the internet, and you can take a look on social media, but I'm seeing some people are getting some Groove-It brushes now. There's some arrivals going out there. So again, get on this list if you haven't already.
Why should they get a Groovit brush, Alex? Is it because of the built-in pump? Is it because of the magnets that you can pop it off the bag?
Those
or is it because of 3-year bristle guarantee? I mean, which reason?
All those works. Maybe the idea that the 3-year bristle guarantee is unmatched by any of the competitors too. So like if the bristle wears out in that time period or less, you should get it replaced. That's a great Groovit guarantee.
Crazy. It's incredible reliability. So prepare to be amazed with the consistency and control that clean grooves will give you. Using your existing clubs with the Groovit, you'll get the spin, trajectory, and consistency you're looking for. So head on over to grooveitbrush.com, get on the pre-order list, and maybe it'll find its way to you pretty quickly. Who knows? Looks like it might. So again, that's grooveitbrush.com.
Next up from Toronto, Ontario, we've got an award-winning chef, restaurateur who does a little bit of everything. He's also the host of Man Fire Food as well, to a really cool TV show that we're going to get into. It's Roger Mooking joining the Course of Life. Roger, how are we doing today?
I'm okay. How are you doing, Alex?
Doing very well. Appreciate you taking the time to hop on. Love the show. We'll get into that in a little bit, but let's first get into your background because it's a very interesting one. Born in Trinidad, raised in Canada, and you have, from what I understand, both Chinese and Caribbean influences in your family. So my main question for you is, your kitchen must have been lit growing up, right? Well, what were the kind of flavors coming out of your kitchen as a kid?
Well, we ate everything growing up, you know, and I didn't realize that everybody's house wasn't like that really until I started going to people's houses, you know, and I would see that they just ate like, you know, cheese spread on toast and like macaroni in a box and like stuff like that. I was like, what is this? I never seen that stuff until I was a teenager, right? So, but we ate everything. We ate dim sum. We ate Caribbean food of all kinds. We ate African food, we ate Caribbean, Ukrainian food, we like Polish food, Spanish food, and I thought everybody ate like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of adults out there listening that would have killed to have those type of tastes growing up in their household. That's a very neat experience, and it kind of got you into the variety of cooks that you do on the show as it stands today. And in terms of your background as well, in addition, there's a little bit of everything you do, like I mentioned at the top, but in your culture and career as well, you come from a family of food, but you also have a big background in music as well. How early was music in your life, in addition to the variety of food that you had in your kitchen as a kid, and when did you know that music would be in your life the way it is?
Well, I just never remember a time where there was never music. My father was a big record collector before we moved from Canada. He brought some of his select choice records with him to Canada. My brother kind of carried on that tradition of listening to and collecting music during like the hip hop era, the 80s, and he started DJing and collecting a lot of records. And so between my father's collection, which he has like the deepest collection I know of old calypsos of anybody that I know, as well as everything from like Simon and Garfunkel to Santana to Fela Kuti to like everything was in our house, right? Kenny Rogers. And then my brother started collecting whole hip hop records, you know, like Nucleus and the Roxanne Battles and Grandmaster Flash, the Furious Five, the Fat Boys. And then I kind of dove into it and started diving into like Ice-T, Public Enemy, N.W.A., Ice Cube, and, you know, still to this day. So I don't ever recall a memory without music.
Love that. And the record collectors, feel like that's a very unique audience. And there's always some very epic collections that you can see, especially from people like in your family as well, too. So life in music, life in the kitchen as well, too. In terms of taking your food professionally and getting out into the dining scene in Toronto, Ontario, explain to people what that was like for you growing up and kind of earning your chops and working at different kitchens in the city, and what lessons you learned that kind of helped make you the person you are today.
Well, when my family moved from Trinidad, I was 5 years old. We moved to Edmonton, Alberta. So I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta until I was about 17, 18 years old. So I started working in kitchens in Edmonton in my teen years. And I would work in like the family diner type places, like, you know, like the equivalent of Denny's in Canada kind of thing. I kind of started out there. And at that time, I started doing music. And the music really took off. I moved to Toronto for the entertainment industry. I did that for a long time and then left the core of doing that day to day after like a decade. And then I went back into kitchens and I went to culinary school. I started working in French bistros and hotels, catering companies, restaurants of all varieties. And just kind of took with, you know, my family history of being around food and took all this new knowledge of being in kitchens and being in kitchens from when I was a teenager and kind of mashed that all together and launched, one of my first restaurants I was the executive chef at was a small, like 30 seat restaurant on the east side of Toronto, where my first job as executive chef was. And then there I met some of my business partners at that shortly after that. And we opened a series of restaurants in Toronto, kind of exploring and just celebrating, you know, what I knew how to do, which is just cook a variety of different foods. And then that launched and we did those things for years. I started doing TV shows around that time, still releasing albums again. And before you know it, this kind of conglomerate of like TV shows and restaurants and music and all this stuff popping. And then I sold a bunch of the restaurants. And now I have a restaurant in Toronto Pearson International Airport called Twist.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very cool to have a restaurant featured in an international airport as well, too. So that's a really cool look in your background and the culture like really intersects with everything that you've done in your career, the music, pop culture, the food, it all comes together. And then you see that shine through on your personality on the shows that you do. Let's first rewind the tape to, I think it was 2011 or 2012 when Man Fire Food first got going. You being in kitchens and climbing every step of the ladder, like you mentioned in the culinary industry, what was that like to like get that? Do you remember getting that call or having that opportunity come your way for the show and what your first reactions were?
Well, Man Fire Food was like probably the fifth show that I've been a host of, you know, at that point. I first started doing shows in 2008. I used to run this small restaurant called Barrio, like I said, it's a small 30-seat restaurant. And it just happened to be around the corner where Food Network used to film their shows at that time in Canada. Oh, okay. And so, you know, long story short, after a few years of kind of going back and forth, we finally launched this show called Everyday Exotic in Canada. Then we sold that show around the world. And then Cooking Channel picked up on that show. It took off really well in America with Cooking Channel. And then after that, I did a show called Heat Seekers with Aaron Sanchez. And I did a bunch of like guests on like Chopped and Iron Chef and this, that, the other thing. And then it kind of morphed into this conversation was floating around inside Food Network and inside Cooking Channel for a while about this show Cooking with a Fire. And one of the executives thought I'd be a good match for that idea. So we went out, we shot a pilot for it, and it took off, man. And, you know, 9 seasons later, Man Fire Food's kicking, you know?
Yeah, that show's got some serious staying power on Food TV. It's been around for a while. And let's get into that aspect specifically. So you got recruited because they knew the show was going to be surrounding live fire cooking. Kind of the difference between your show and a lot of everything else that you see on Food TV. You know, a lot of shows are just very, you know, formulaic in a kitchen setting indoors where things are placed and very prearranged and it's quite, you know, organized. I love the start to finish that you do. Talk about live fire cooking and just what attracts you to it and like the number one reason why people should try it more often.
You know, from a kid, I was always like enamored with fire, a little bit of a closet pyromaniac, you know?
Yes.
And I was always enamored by it. And I think that if anybody sits around a fire long enough, they too are enamored because it's just mesmerizing. There's something primal about being around a fire. It provides warmth. It keeps you dry. It provides heat. You can cook on it. There's just something very, just like I said, just very primal about a fire. The show was really a vision of the executive producer and creator, Irene Wong. And I kind of fell into what the concept was, and me being a natural kind of pyromaniac, I loved it. And I had played around with cooking with fire a bit, but not to the extremes and the breadth that I have experienced over the course of doing Man Fire Food. But yeah, I just, you know, I think there's just something really interesting in about just going back. It forces you to slow down. It forces you to be mindful. You can't walk away from it and come back in 5 hours. You have to pay attention to it. You have to coddle it. You have to nudge it. You have to play with it. You have to enforce it. You have to tame it, like, or else the food doesn't turn out. And at the end of the day, it's about still cooking delicious food.
Definitely. I love that. Great messaging. Again, it's Man Fire Food. You can see it on Food TV. Let's get into some of the episodes that I liked and highlight some of these different cool live fire cooking aspects that you've showcased on the show. First one, so my roots are in New England. So when I saw that you went up to Maine and you did the very unique live fire Maine lobster boil, I got really excited and I love the finished product. I encourage people to check out that episode. What was the coolest part about doing the lobster boil under live fire, and kind of how did that all come together for you?
I mean, you know, the crew does and the team does a really good job of researching interesting locations with good people and that they think that I'll get along with and that I'll enjoy what they do. So by the time we get there, we have a good sense that that should happen. But, you know, for me, it's just curiosity. I've never been to a live lobster boil exactly like that one. So I walk into every scenario like that, like it's a new adventure, and to understand what I could do to kind of satisfy my curiosity around that particular event, you know, and it didn't disappoint. You know, I love lobster. I love seafood. I love crab. So, you know, it fulfilled a lot of boxes for me.
Definitely. What are the unique flavors that come from doing like a lobster boil like that over live fire? What sort of seasonings were used? Or, you know, there's a lot of people from New England listening to this podcast that would love some tips on how to make their seafood taste a little more fresh like it did in that boil. So were there any secrets? I know you're always good at trying to extract the secret recipes on the show, but what were some of the keys for that episode specifically to make the flavor so great?
Well, you know, the secret is always nature, my friend, you know. So at the end of the day, we're in Maine. They're surrounded by lobsters at the peak of the season, and we're getting them at the peak of the season. That's just the beginning, right?
Yeah.
You take that out of context and you lose, you know, lobsters, once they're out of their water and not eating, they start to consume themselves and they diminish in size and sweetness and all of the stuff that we enjoy as consumers very quickly. They diminish hour by hour. So, you know, to be able to get it fresh from the sea, it has nothing to do with me, man. We just plucked it, you know?
Love that. Awesome. One other place I want to highlight is where I live now. Austin, Texas, a great city, which I know you spent a lot of time in. You've done some great content in the Lone Star State as well. You went to Bangers. You were part of the Saturday smokeout they do, where you actually did some goat in what's called a Cajun microwave. They explained to everyone that process and what a Cajun microwave exactly is.
Well, you know, what I love is, first, I love Ted out there, man. Ted is a homie out there. He's like super nicest, coolest guy. And what they do out there is like they have this live fire playground in this backyard setting sort of environment. It's very communal, very friendly, engaging, and passionate, very much like Ted and his team there, you know. So I love what they do out there. And you know, just there's so many contraptions that they have there. I could go on and on about them, but the Cajun microwave is basically like a clamshell type design sort of oven, I guess, you know, that's built around cooking over live fire, but it really comes from the passion of the people there.
Very cool. And obviously where I am in Texas, when we get talking about meats in Texas, it obviously has to turn into a Texas barbecue conversation because that's big in my parts. You know a lot about wood and how different types of woods create different live fires for smoking meats. I'm curious, what's your favorite? I know you've been to a lot of the great Texas barbecue spots as well. Do you have a preference, or do you lean people who are making barbecue towards cooking with a certain type of wood?
You know, I really like the more neutral hardwoods, like oak or you know, hickory could be a little bit more stronger flavor, but like I like those neutral hardwoods mixed with fruit woods. So, you know, you take like fruit or nut woods, you take like oak or hickory as the kind of the fulcrum of the cooking, and you add a piece or two of cherry or a piece or two of apple for a select amount of time. And it just is that perfect balance of the right amount of smoke, a little bit of sweetness and aromatics, and just a nice, even, solid cook, you know, which is what you're looking for. So some woods can be really overpowering with the smoke, and you just got to find that balance. So I find that that's the sweet spot for me.
Nice. I love that combo. You're making me want Smell-O-Vision right now, describing that. The show Man Fire Food definitely needs it. So there's a taste of kind of what people can expect in the show. Now, whenever I watch the show, first, it's very bingeable. They show it several times a day, often on Saturdays as well, too. So it's easy to watch a bunch of episodes and see you profile these different places. I'm curious, what are like your basic tips for people who see the show, they love it, they're like, I want to cook over a fire. What are some simple things that people need to know if they're just getting into this, or simple ways to execute a real straightforward live fire cook?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you have to respect the fire, right? You know, fire is a living, breathing thing, and one strong wind or one blowing ember can turn into a disaster. So at every given moment, you have to respect the fire. You have to know that the fire is in control, really. You are not, you're just trying to tame it. So respect the fire. Make sure you have like extinguishers or water around, a fire blanket. First of all, be very safe, right? Secondly, you know, use and understand what's around you. You know, so if you're living in an environment where there's a lot of pecan or a lot of mesquite or a lot of hickory, a lot of oak, you know, use what's available locally. And, you know, in Texas, they got lots of beef, so you have no shortage of access to good quality beef. And use what's around you, and there's all the resources, especially around you there in Texas, all the resources are surrounding, and you know, and you kind of got to look at what you want to do. Do you want something that's quick and fast? Well, then you approach it one way. If you want to hang out by a fire for, you know, 16 hours, drink some beers with some friends and play some what's that game? That beanbag toss game.
Yeah, cornhole. That's a good one.
You want to play cornhole and hang out, and then do that, but know that they know it's a long, slow cook, and you're gonna have to feed that thing. And so, it really, is what you want to get out of it, and what you want to put into it, right?
If we're doing the long, slow fire, I got to ask, well, what's maybe your drink of preference? Well, what do you prefer to sip as you're sitting by the fire watching it?
I don't drink a lot, to be honest. I like ciders, you know, I'm like a lightweight, my friend, you know, I'm pretty low key. I drink water, cider, green tea. I'm pretty low key.
Good stuff. Again, it's Man Fire Food, but I also want to touch on another show you work on as well. Man's Greatest Food. What can viewers expect on this? This show is kind of more of a quest for the best. It looks like we're hitting all different points of the country, but when people are tuning into Man's Greatest Food, what can they look out for?
You know, it's just like a cornucopia of flavors based around a theme. So, you know, we may focus on the greatest pizzas around the country, the greatest barbecue, the greatest sandwiches, the best thing between three pieces of bread, like whatever the theme is. And we kind of just dive in and find out what those things are. I know the things may not like match everybody's palate, but there's going to be something on every episode for at least one person, you know? So it's kind of like a feast for the eyes, and you pick from it what you love.
Love it. Again, it's Roger Mooking, Man Fire Food, Man's Greatest Food, both out, available to watch whenever you have our time to do so. I definitely encourage it. Let's get to some rapid fire questions before we sign off. One thing I always do is I do a quick check on the Wikipedia, because there's always like varying amounts of true and false information on there. But I wanted to check something I saw on there. It said, there's a quote that you never have cooked the same thing twice. Is that a Wikipedia exaggeration, or is that the real deal?
No, I don't really cook the same thing twice. You know, like even if I make biscuits, for instance, I make biscuits like 100 times, you know, in the last couple of years, let's say for my family, right? I'll always experiment. I'll mix the different types of flour. I'll add different types of butter. I'll use more butter, more flour. I'll change the cooking temperature slightly. And just all an experimentation. You know, I've figured out a way to make really great biscuits, but you know, maybe there's another way to make even greater biscuits.
Right. Well, never ending quest for perfection, right?
Yeah, I don't know about perfection, just experimentation, you know, just new experiences, yeah. Right? I think that the human condition is one of adaptation, right? So, you know, you got to adapt and feed that.
Good stuff. Let's talk about, give me the most extreme, ridiculous, craziest fire to cook with that you've highlighted on Man Fire Food. There's tons of them. I wanted you to pick and tell our audience which one is just the most ridiculous contraption you've seen for a live fire cook on the show.
Ridiculous contraption. I mean, we cooked a whole cow once on this like steel engineer. They were these engineers who do this charitable barbecue thing. And so they engineered this steel contraption that allows you to cook a whole cow over a fire. It spins, it rotates, it flips. And you can imagine like this thousands of pound animal trying to move and flip around. The steel contraption has to be engineered to suit, right? So that was pretty impressive.
Good stuff. And the final question is our 19th hole question. It has something to do with what happens at the end of your day. So I know for you at the end of a live fire cook, chances are at the end, there's some sort of dessert that we like to do. I've seen you highlight some desserts in the show, but what's your favorite dessert to do over a live fire? It's a very interesting angle putting dessert on live fire, but what's your favorite to make personally?
I really love the peach and berry cobblers like that, you know, like those. I love those with some just really good vanilla ice cream, a little bit of caramel on top, man. Life is spectacular.
Yes, life is spectacular. That's a great way to finish. Roger Mooking, thank you for joining. Loving all the concepts, the content, and the TV shows you're putting out, and looking forward to more live fires as well.
Thanks very much, Alex. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
That interview with Roger Mooking is thanks to our friends at Desert Fox Golf, the makers of the Phone Caddy. It's a one-of-a-kind phone holder for golfers designed to mount right onto the golf cart. The Phone Caddy works seamlessly with any phone model. It velcros onto the cart in seconds, keeping your yardage and scoring apps open and at your fingertips. You can change music, answer calls and texts, all and more with the Phone Caddy. It's the most functional way to keep your phone safe and ready on the course at all times. Time is running out to get it as a stocking stuffer or holiday gift. It is mid-December, so now's the time to get it. And you can save 20% off your purchase of the Phone Caddy with the promo code COURSEOFLIFE. Get 20% off the Phone Caddy of your choice for the person you love, including 20% off of their patriotic line, typically excluded from any deal. So again, get the Phone Caddy with promo code COURSEOFLIFE at DesertFoxGolf.com. Again, that's promo code COURSEOFLIFE for 20% off DesertFoxGolf.com. And we're back. Great interview there with Roger Mooking. You know, cooking over a fire just brings you back to Cro-Magnon Man, when that was how you just make fire and put meat on fire and cook and then eat meat.
Well said. It's so primal, isn't it? Like you said, yeah. You know, just kind of, it really just like kind of brings out the soul in you when you sit by a fire. Yeah. It's mesmerizing, like Roger said. And it just kind of like, there's good memories always associated around a fire. Mm-hmm. I feel like you've always got good company, you know, good drink, good food, you know, good vibes around a fire. So I appreciate Roger bringing that to life in Man Fire Food. And like I said, and he highlighted a few of the adventures in there, he goes to some really cool places where they do live fire cooking.
Yeah, I mean, I think of like a lot of these things, a lot of food that you cook over an open fire, like a lobster boil or a pig roast, you get a huge amount of people there. So obviously we're not doing it now, but when you do, you get to hang out with all kinds of different people and meet them and eat good food. I mean, what's not to love?
I had this festival, Western Massachusetts. It was called the Pig and Pepper Festival. I have no idea if it still even exists or not, but I used to go with my dad as a kid. And basically the festival was just dozens and dozens of tents of vendors. And it just basically was surrounding the theme of, you either made a hot sauce and sold it and you got to try it, or you cooked pig on a roast and that baby was just spinning all day and you could just buy whatever kind of meat you wanted. That is just my kind of festival, and that's Roger's kind of vibe as well too. And like I said, he brings that in the show. Really cool show, Man Fire Food. And then like we mentioned, Man's Greatest Food, Wednesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern on the Cooking Channel.
of it. And if you loved that interview as much as we did, plus everything else we do here, go ahead and give us a rating and subscribe on the podcast app of your choice. It really means a lot to us when we see people tell us they love us. We get all warm and fuzzy inside, and we get inflated egos, and Alex starts telling me how great he is.
Yeah, we're very, very sensitive egos, so we need our personality stroked as much as possible.
Speaking of sensitive egos.
Yes, what about?
How quickly can this college football season end for you?
This is just such a mess now. I'm just hanging over 50% for the season right now in my picks. They're on Twitter at Course of Life 1.
And that's what you guarantee, right? You guarantee at least a penny made on the season.
And that, right? That's got to happen at 55% is the reality, because Vegas is taking some juice. You know, you got to bet $11 or $12 to win 10 every time you make a bet. That's the bottom line. So you really got to be hitting 55% of your bets. And I'm not there yet. We are quickly running out of time. Like, I can't wait for the season to end. It can't end fast enough. My last hope is bowl season. I usually make a little bit of hay back in bowl season with some mismatches, but the unpredictability is just through the roof. How many games have been postponed every week, and guys who are randomly out, you know, day of due to testing or contact tracing or something. There's just so many elements that I was not ready to work with this season.
And we've seen mismatches. We've seen games that we thought were going to go one way and they went another. We've seen big teams topple down. So, you know, it's I think you thinking you're going to make money back in bowl season, I hate to say it, you could be rudely awake.
That's great. I look forward to chronicling that against at Twitter, at Course of Life 1 on Twitter. You're at MWRINC to make fun of me as that happens in the next few weeks. But nonetheless, the calamity of conference championship weekend this weekend. We're going to find out the four next week. I'll be able to officially preview the college football playoffs, which are going to happen. And there's going to be four teams. We just don't know which yet. So
I will say, at least you have a little bit more time to put into college football, because your Patriots are really kind of done, right?
Yes. This is an extremely unfamiliar position for me, Mike. I said you before you hopped on, there's 3 weeks left in the NFL season, and the season is like 98% over for the Patriots. There's one tiny path in which they win out in the AFC East and a whole bunch of teams do a bunch of weird things, but it's really essentially done. So, like, I find myself doing random things, like just watching random NFL games between two teams that aren't the Patriots. This is something I can't say I've done in decades. It's quite amazing. There's other teams out there.
There's a whole breadth of other football teams that play on Sundays. I don't know if you knew this.
This is all new information to me. So the 6-7 Patriots, again, just crushed by the Rams. That was our hope, is to win the Thursday night, sweep the division, get in at 10-6. That's all but gone now. There's a path to 9-7, but I don't see it happening. Tough times in Foxborough. You know, everyone should just really feel bad for us, because it's really been tough being a Patriots fan this season. And, you know, since we've been able to win. So it's coming. I can hear it from everyone else in our audience out there. But you, my friend, you actually have more, not much life, but more than the Patriots, which is
Season's over. Do you see what happened this last week? Season's over. I don't know what I've been talking about. Yeah, I don't remember what I say every week on this podcast. I just open mouth and words come out. So I can't hold myself to anything I said last week or weeks prior. But, season's over. Yeah, I don't know what I've been saying.
There's
season's
no need for anyone to check back in past episodes and confirm what your prior opinions were on the season either, too.
No. Not at all. Not at all. Season's over.
So it's done. Over.
Especially after that embarrassment of this last week.
Okay, I mean, you're not far from the football team. You're what, a game back? There's room. There's games in the season. No more.
The Washington football team started the showing off of how overrated the Pittsburgh Steelers are.
They did.
Right. Because now the Steelers have lost two games in a row. So they're done. Steelers are done. The Washington football team won again. So they now got a little bit of a cushion going into the last couple weeks of conference play here. It's over.
Good
it's
stuff. Over. 7-8 wins going to win that division. We thought it might be 6-10, but it looks like a team will get to 7. We'll see if that could potentially be you guys. I'm rooting for you in a weird ass way. I'm rooting for you, Mike. I don't know why, but I am. So best of luck.
Should we go back to Colt McCoy? Do you think that's what it is? Let the Colt McCoy era really started off right, and that's what we got to go back to.
Connection's nice for me. You know, Colt McCoy helped open some Dunkin' Donuts franchises here in Austin, so I'm forever faithful to him in a weird roundabout way. So, I don't know. We'll see what's in store for your G-man in the next few weeks. I love that we've called the season over on four or five different occasions, and it's still not technically over. That's the joke in this whole thing.
The only 2020. Yeah. Let's hashtag always in with food.
Yeah, let's do it. Brought to you by Be Free CBD, promo code COL30, 30% off any of their CBD products. Again, Be Free CBD on social, BeFreeCBD.com, 30% off. It is Christmas meal time. It's holiday meal time. Mm. It's Hanukkah week. We have plans. We have meals in the works. Like, starting to put the notes down. You know, Thanksgiving is one big meal where you lock in on that Thursday and you've got some leftovers. The nice part about Christmas and the holidays in these next couple weeks is there's, I feel like there's like four or five occasions where you can go all out and do like a real meal if you want. So what's made your itinerary officially?
Standing rib roast is going to happen.
Oh, that's so fancy. Like the standing up, the bones are facing northward, correct?
Something like, I don't know. It's prime rib. I mean, it's so, you know, I don't think I've actually ever made one of these. I've had it. My parents have made it before. So I'm going to have to rely on my memory of what they made for us. But, you know, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, I just did straight up steak. And why not step it up a notch and let's go all out with standing rib roast?
So I'm a year behind you. That's a wonderful segue. I just got the light just hit me to order some steaks this year. So we actually have some, I have some lobster meat that is frozen from like a few weeks back that I was saving for an occasion. I decided I'm going bougie. I'm going to be doing a ribeye steak dinner during Christmas week at some point, TBD, with a lobster béarnaise sauce. On top, like a real surf and turf meal. So that's what I'm going to be going for in the next week here. I will take any advice or suggestions on Twitter at Course of Life One if you've got any techniques to make that an amazing meal. But I don't think I'm going to have to do much to make it tasty.
No, I mean, just don't ruin the sauce. That's really where it's all going to come down. It can't be too hard. Don't ruin
it. One thing I did want to shout out before we sign off is the cookies that you put on Instagram. Mm. We're at COL Podcast. If you want to follow the general pod page on Instagram, we post content there. You put them up there and on your Instagram at MWRINC. The 7-layer cookies, Mike, do explain. One more time went into that.
It is an Italian flag of perfection.
Well,
it's... It is 3 layers of a almond flavored, what I believe is technically a Genoese sponge that is then sandwiched together with apricot preserves between the layers and then chocolate on the top and bottom. It takes a day and a half, takes a good 2 days there to make. But the result is fantastic. If you were to buy these in a store, you're talking like, you know, these aren't very big. These are less than an inch long and maybe like 3/4, you know, half an inch wide or something. They're not very big little rectangles. You only need 2 or 3 of them. And you're probably talking for 2 or 3, if you were to buy these in a store, good ones in a store, you know, $4 or $5.
Oh yeah. That's a bougie dessert. That takes some time to make. That's a full on operation. And check out the pictures because I don't even care what they taste like. Honestly, those IG photos were so dang attractive of those cookies. Mm-hmm. They photograph well, Mike. So nice
job. I might have stepped up my food photographing game and actually put them on a plate and put them in a nice spot in the house and took a nice picture.
There it is. Everything counts. Shout out to AZ Food Guy who taught us all about framing our food picks. You can listen to that interview in the archives as well, too. Puts the wrap on another great episode of The Course of Life. Thank you, everyone, for joining, and we'll see you next week.